short and sweet.
Thank you.
I like those short and sweet introductions. You know, they don't build you up too much. My name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And I am so grateful to be here this morning with, what about 200, 300 of my best friends. Those of us that get up at this hour obviously really want to show up at an AA meeting. So thanks for not letting me be here all by myself. I want to thank Fred. Where'd Cuz go? Where is he? Oh, my God. I am getting old for sure. Where are my glasses? I want to thank Fred and Martha for this wonderful invitation to be of service. You know, I feel like we're family. I've known them for such a long time. I mean, they literally have watched me grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth is, if you really want to know, we probably are family. We share the same last name, Fred and I, or it's somewhere along the line. So you know what? Somebody's been sleeping around with somebody. I don't know. And I'm a Georgia girl, so it's very likely. Very, very likely. So us Wards, we've just been hanging around. My folks are from Atlanta, so, cuz. Oh, I'm a little chilly up here, so I'm kind of warming up. I also want to say last night when Chet spoke, and thank you so much for a great talk, you brought back really powerful memories of Bob and Ruth P. And, you know, that the reason I first got to the South in the first place in terms of speaking in AA was because of Bob. You know, he was the one that invited me to my very first AA conference. I think it was Orlando State, maybe 20 years, 15 years or 17 years, something like that. And then he kept me here. You know, he kept inviting me to more southern places. And before you know it, it was like I was home again. But I really remember them. And, you know, it just tells you that if you stick around long enough, you develop history. You develop some history. And if you're newly sober, I want to just welcome you to the most amazing experience of your lives. The most amazing. And you know what? If you are new this morning, you're probably sitting here saying, yeah, right. It's easy for you to say it's so amazing. But the truth is, if you stick around long enough for the fog to lift, you will really get what an awesome gift you have been given just to be present in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me forewarn you, if you've never heard me speak before, if you've never heard me speak before and you have a problem with middle-aged women who can't control their emotions, you might want to leave right about now. Because I make absolutely no apologies from crying at the podium. I leak all the time. And, you know, it just is the way it is. So if that kind of shakes you up, there are a few doors here. I came in yesterday and I flew into Jacksonville because it was easier for me coming from the San Francisco area. I live in Mill Valley, California, which is right outside of San Francisco, really pretty part of the country. Oh, and my sobriety date is July 26, 1979. And thank you. And my home group is the Barge Meeting, which meets noon on Wednesdays in Sausalito. And so if you're ever in that part of the country and you want to participate in a meeting that literally looks onto the water. We're on a barge looking on the water. Please come join us. But anyway, I came into Jacksonville yesterday and I decided to rent a car to come here to make it easy for the conference so they wouldn't have to drive there and pick me up. And it was great because as I drove from Jacksonville to here, my heart was just so full of gratitude at every moment. I just, you know, it wasn't a very long drive. It was a relatively easy drive, and even though I was in a strange car, you know, in a strange area, but I just kept thanking God. You know, number one, that I was in a car that I was driving, that I was clean and sober and able to drive, you know, from one place to another safely, that I had a license that was legitimate, and it was mine. That I didn't have an accident along the way. I just kept thanking God for so many things. And if you hear nothing else from me in the next 45 or so minutes, I want you to get how much I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous for what it has given me. Absolutely love it because, you see, I am one of those people who should not be standing here. I'm one of those women who has come from a place that, for all intents and purposes, at this stage of my life, I shouldn't even have a life. I should be underneath the ground somewhere. But you see, I get to stand before you, a walking, talking, breathing example of Alcoholics Anonymous in the flesh. I get to stand before you this morning, an example of someone who has been given a second chance. You know, in Amazing Grace, it talks about saving a wretch like me. That's how I feel. You know, every time I hear that song, I just leak all over because, you know, it's so me. It's like I've been lifted. I've been lifted. And Alcoholics Anonymous was the vehicle that lifted me. I was born 54 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, and I am sober more than half of my life. More than half of my life. I mean, it blows me away. Might not do much for you, but I look at myself in the mirror, number one, I don't believe I'm 54. That's one thing. But I am, and I have a sponsee here who drove up from New York, Savannah via New York, and she knows me from all those years, she knows. But I was born 54 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, and you know, I don't remember a lot about those very, very early days of my life. I'd love to stand up here and tell you I remember everything I did when I was a kid, but I don't. I'm way too old. I don't. But you know what I do remember? I remember that as a child, my experience overall was a painful one. That I do remember. I remember as a kid, I just hurt all the time. And you know, some of you can probably relate to that. Even though the details of our stories are different, I would imagine that many of you can connect with the feelings. You know, because our feelings are pretty much the same if we're in here. And as a kid, I hurt all the time. I used to wish I could kind of unzip my skin and step out. That's how painful it was for me growing up in the South and growing up in New York City, because my family moved to New York when I was 6 years old. And it was horrible being inside this body. You know, when I was a little kid, I always wanted to fit in, and I never quite could do that. I was always like that round peg in a square hole. I never fit anywhere. It didn't matter if I was in a room with people who were just like me. I just never fit. I just was always uncomfortable. And, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, many years later, I realized the terms they use, that we use, are irritable, what is it, irritable, restless, irritable, and discontent. And that was me all the time, inside my body. And so, if there was anybody paying attention to me as a little child, if there was anybody who was sensitive to kids and sensitive to the pain that kids go through, they probably knew at an early age I was going to find a way out of that gnawing pain. They probably knew that at some point in time I was going to find something. Maybe they didn't know what it was, but I was going to find something that was going to lift me up from that torture that I lived in every day of my life. And I can tell you, long before I ever picked up a drink or a drug, my earliest escape in life came through books and movies. I'm an old movie buff. I love books. My mom was a librarian. And in our house, in every room, on every wall, there were reams and reams and reams of books. They were everywhere. It was so awesome. I mean, books everywhere. You know, I remember there was an old Twilight Zone years ago. Some of you might remember it was about the books, and the guy was a reader. I don't remember all the details, but all I remember is at the end, it was him and all these books. And that's how it was in my house. There were books and books and books. And sometimes I'd go take a book off the shelf, and I'd sit in the corner all by myself, and I'd open up the binder. And I think my mom probably thought I was trying to become a smart kid, because I just would read and read and read. But you know what was happening? It wasn't I was trying to become smart. You see, what happened for me is when I opened up a book, between those binders was magic. That was the deal. There was magic between those binders. I opened up a book and all of a sudden, I was Cinderella going to the ball. All of a sudden, I was beautiful, I was smart, I was cute, I was like fun to be with. As a little kid, when I opened up that book, I was just in heaven. It was great. And you know, it was the same way with old movies. I loved old movies, and I really date myself. It's a good thing I told you my age already. I love women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. Those are my idols. Those are women who had a glass in one hand. They had a cigarette in the other. And they didn't take a whole lot of garbage off anybody. And you know, I love them. I love those women even today, you know. And I remember I used to love old movies when we only had three channels on TV. Remember those days? I mean, it was ABC, NBC, and CBS, and now they're like a million channels. You get dizzy. But I remember when all the old movies were sprinkled on all those three channels, and I just sit in front of the tube and watch the movies. And you know, I learned a lot about being a female by watching those women. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about how to walk, how to hold myself, how to, you know, how to do everything by watching Bette Davis and Joan Crawford and Susan Hayward. I learned how to smoke cigarettes by watching Bette Davis in the movie All About Eve. Anybody remember that movie? It was one of my favorites. There's a scene in that movie where she was having a party and she's walking up that staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder, talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. I thought, had she only known how bumpy the ride was to become. You know, oh, thank you. And I learned how to hold my glass with my pinky stuck out by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. And if you remember that movie, there are a few other tricks of the trade I learned from watching her in that movie. I'm not proud to admit this about my history, but I learned how to sleep with other people's husbands by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. That was the whole premise of the movie. You know, and for years and years, these women became my role models. For years and years, women in movies and women on the television taught me everything I knew how to do. And eventually, of course, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous many years later, I had to relearn some of those bad behaviors and learn new things by watching women here. But for a long time, the books and the movies worked. For a long time, they took me to a place that was sweet and fun and different from the place I knew growing up as a kid. And then what always happens with us when we use something outside of ourselves to take away the pain, eventually the books and the movies stop working. That simple. Instead of taking me away from the pain of growing up as this poor little kid from Atlanta, Georgia, who moved to the South Bronx in New York, instead of taking me away from the pain of that experience, the books and the movies at the end started to make it perfectly clear that this was my life and that was all that I had. That this was the hand I was dealt, whether I liked it or not. And you know what? I didn't like it. I didn't like the hand I was dealt. I didn't like being, you know, born a black kid in a community that didn't embrace that. I didn't like being a little girl who just hated who she was. I didn't like anything about my experience. I didn't like being poor. I hated the fact that we'd have to hang out in our apartment with rats that were the size of cats. I didn't like the fact that I would eat plaster off the wall because sometimes we were so hungry. I didn't like that experience. And yet, at this stage in my life, I woke up and I realized when the books and movies stopped working that this was all there was, period. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I then decided I was going to run right out and use drugs and alcohol. But I can tell you on some very deep level, that's what I was drawn to. Because the pain was still too great. I couldn't just not do anything. I could not do anything. It was too much. And so at the age of 14 years old, I picked up my first chemical, and I didn't put it down again until I was 26. And between those years, from 14 to 26, and it wasn't a long time, but it was time enough to do a lot of damage. You know, I remember when I first got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, those old-timers never once, when they heard my story, never once told me, "I spilled more than you drank." You know, like they used to tell a lot of newcomers that. They never told me that because it would have been a lie. You know. So I picked up at 14, and I had a love affair with alcohol. And I'm not going to tell you I liked the taste because I am not one of those people who liked the taste of alcohol. But the truth is, it didn't matter. You know, it really didn't matter whether I liked it or I didn't. The point is, I liked what it did for me. And it liked what it did to me. And when I drank and used, I was taken to the same place I used to be in when I picked up a book. I went to a different place. It was wonderful. Alcohol and drugs took me to places, let me say this, it was wonderful for the moment. And then it took me to places that were horrific. Alcohol and drugs took me to places that I would have never gone but for the fact that I was a drunk. I found myself coming to people I would have never even given the time of day to had I been coherent. I found myself coming to in places, doing things that I would have never even thought of doing. You see, what happened to me as an alcoholic female were things that my mother never taught me to do. You know, my mom taught me to be a really good little kid. I mean, we didn't have a lot, but she still taught me to be the best little kid I could be. But something happened to me along the way when I picked up a drink or a drug, and I lost all sense of right, all sense of wrong, all sense of dignity, all sense of not wanting to compromise myself. I eventually went to places that were just so horrific. I ended up selling my body for many, many years. And I just want to stop here for a moment because it took a long time for me, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be able to admit that to you. I remember I used to take seriously where it says we share in a general way what it used to be like. I would share so generally that you had no idea where I had gone or what I had done. And today I get to tell you that I'm an ex-hooker with a criminal record because, number one, that's not who I am anymore. And number two, because I'm no longer ashamed of my past. I'm no longer ashamed. And again, the reason I'm no longer ashamed of my past is because that's not who I am anymore. I am not that person. But for years and years, alcohol and drugs took me to a place where I sold my life, my soul, my body, for a drink or a drug. I think when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the hardest things was to deal with the shame of that past. And so I'm particularly talking to someone in here this morning, and it may only be one person, but I'm particularly talking to the person in here today who is today riddled with shame. And you might be somebody with a lot of time, and you might be somebody with a little time. But that shame eats us up. It eats us up, it tears us apart, and then it takes us back out doing the very things we said we hated doing in the first place. Because the shame is deadly. It's like an insidious disease. And many years I was ashamed of who I was. The good news is I didn't keep acting. Well, in the beginning I acted out, and then eventually I learned through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't have to keep doing that. I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978 in New York City. And I remember the woman who was my sponsor, or she tried to be. It's a little hard to sponsor somebody when they're drinking. We know that. But she, June, God bless her, she used to read to me from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whenever she'd come to the part about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, she never stopped to explain it to me because she knew I knew exactly what that was about. She knew I knew what it felt like to be a woman who had pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized herself. I knew exactly what that was. You know, at the end of my drinking, I would come home from doing whatever it was I was doing in the streets of New York, and I would stand under the shower, and I would scrub, and I would scrub, and I would scrub my body, trying to take off what I thought was the surface dirt. And some of you can probably relate to that if you're real alcoholics. You know, we think if we use soap and water, it's going to clean us up. If we wear pretty clothes, it's going to make us feel better. If we are attached to him or her, nobody's going to smell the stench that's underneath. Pretty fragrance. And I'd scrub. I'd remember being in the shower and I'd scrub and I'd scrub. And sometimes I'd get abrasions on my skin because I'd scrub so hard trying to take what I thought was that surface dirt off. But you know what? It never came off. It never came off because the dirt I was trying to remove was not the dirt from the outside. It was the dirt that's deeply embedded on the inside. The kind of dirt that says if you lie down with scum, that's what you become. And you see, that's what I had become toward the end of my drinking. I had become the kind of scum that in the Big Book it talks about, those sordid companions, except it relates it to other people. You see, I had become the sordid companion. I was the pathetic one. When I was 18, I was living on the streets as a homeless person because I had no place to go. I had no place to go. You know, today when I see homeless people, there was a time when I would see them and I would put my nose up in the air because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought, you know, I'm better than that. And now when I see homeless people, my heart still goes out to them. Because you see, I remember what it's like. I remember what it was like as a young girl to be living on the streets of New York. I remember those days. not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. One of our promises. In 1978, I didn't get sober, obviously, because I wasn't ready and I was too young. You see, I really believed that if you were 25 years old, you were way too young to be a drunk, let alone to be getting sober. You know, and plus I was a woman, so how could I possibly be an alcoholic? I mean, my idea of a woman alcoholic, my idea of an alcoholic was that old man on the Bowery, you know, the one with the big overcoat. You probably have you don't have a Bowery here on Jekyll Island. No, I forgot where I am. Anyway, in some places we have Boweries. And this old man, the one I used to visualize, had the overcoat and the bottle hanging out of the back of his pocket with those veins popping out of his face. That was an alcoholic. And if by chance it was a woman, well, of course, it was Susan Hayward in I'll Cry Tomorrow. You know, she's digging in the garbage can for a bottle with a little booze in the corner. She was an alcoholic. Or Lee Remick in Days of Wine and Roses. We remember her. She was digging, you know, she would hide her booze in the greenhouse. I didn't have a greenhouse. How could I be an alcoholic? You know? The mind is a powerful thing. It's the thing that tells us we don't have a disease when clearly we do. It tells us we don't. So in 1978, I just continued to drink. I was living in New York at the time, but I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was, you know, the seed had been planted. I kept drinking in between, which makes it a little hard to do anything, but I showed up. I remember going to meetings, and I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd have a bottle in my purse, and I'd take a couple of swigs, and I would think nobody could tell I was drinking. Isn't that amazing? You know, alcoholics think that people can't smell vodka. Now, I'm a former vodka drinker, and I used to believe when people said you can't smell vodka. Well, don't believe it. If you're in here and you're drinking, don't believe it. It is not true. I thought you could not smell it. And so I'd go back into the meeting and people knew. And so let me just take this opportunity to say, if there's anybody in the room this morning who is still drinking on something, and I want you to know I have never in my life been to an AA meeting where there's not somebody on something. Just for the record. I've never been to a meeting where somebody's not on something. So if you are one of those people this morning, I want you to know you are so welcome. You are so welcome, because many of us came here still drinking, sitting in meetings like me. Let me also say, if you are in this meeting this morning and you are still on something and your eyes are dilated and your pupils are constricted and you think we don't know, think again. Think again, because it does not take a rocket scientist to tell when somebody's on something. We may not tell you we know, but we know. And you know, they didn't tell me. But they knew. I'd go to Midtown, and they knew. That was the meeting I used to go to at the time. They knew I was on something. But they just kept loving me back to health. And I moved at the end of 1978. Still drinking. I did what we call a geographic. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is a geographic, where I moved from New York City to Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, go figure. From the frying pan into the fire. I don't know what was on my mind. I guess I just kept thinking free booze, free booze. So I moved from New York to Vegas, and it took really about 9 months for something to happen. It took about 9 months for this God that loved me long before I even loved God, this God to put a stop to my life as I had known it. I moved to Vegas in about October, November. In June of 1979, I got hit by a car in a blackout. And I don't remember what happened today. I don't remember. The last thing I remember was I was sitting in a discotheque in Las Vegas, Nevada, that was appropriately named The Brewery. And then, go figure. And then the next day, I remember coming to with my entire body in traction, and my left leg was in a cast all the way up my left thigh. And I didn't have a clue how it happened. And I remember piecing the story together by what the cops had said and what the doctors had told me. I was told that I was found on Paradise Road, which was the street that I lived on, except in the opposite direction from my house. And I was told that when I was found in the street, they didn't think I was going to live because I was this limp body just lying out in the street. And when they realized I was going to live, they never thought I'd ever walk again, because when I was found, my left leg had come up behind my head and the bone had come straight through. And I have to tell you, I walk around with a limp. My left leg is an entire inch shorter than my right leg, and I can't hide it. It's very apparent. I've got a very unattractive 10-inch scar on my leg that I've chosen not to cover up. I wear shorts, I wear short skirts, I wear bathing suits. You can see it. And often over the years, I've been asked whether I'd consider cosmetic surgery because the scar is so ugly. It is. It's ugly. When I had a lot of pinholes because I had a lot of hardware in my leg for the first year. And I can tell you, just for today, I choose not to cover it up. Just for today. I may change my mind next year, but for today, I have chosen not to have surgery, cosmetic surgery, to cover up the scar. Because you see, every single time I look at my leg, I am reminded of the very high price I had to pay to stand before you this morning. I'm reminded of every drink I took, of every drug I took, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I ever performed. You see, when I look at my leg in the morning, when I look at my leg in the shower, when I just look at my leg, I'm always remembering where I've come from. I'm always remembering those good old days, if you will. Always remembering them. I'd love to tell you that that car accident was really enough to get me sober. I would love to stand up here and tell you that, because it would make for great copy. But the truth is, I'm one of those people that was sicker than most. And I know some of you can relate to that, because I know some of you have lost things, whether it's family, whether it's the use of a leg, whether it's jobs, whether it's houses, whatever, it's whatever. And you still kept drinking and using. And you know, that's my story. Even with a broken leg, even like this close to death, it didn't stop me from drinking. And I continued to drink for another month and a half. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. During that period, I was living in a place in Las Vegas, which was really nice. And I was pretty much confined to my apartment because I didn't know how to drive at the time. And I couldn't get around because I was on crutches. But there was this guy who lived upstairs who I hated with a passion. This guy was a piece of work. He was the lowest piece of nothing on the face of the earth. And you know why I felt that? Because he used to sell his blood and plasma for money for drugs. I thought, what a low life. What a low life. Never dawned upon me what I was selling to get money for drugs. But I thought he was like the worst of the worst. I mean, go figure. Alcoholics, we stand in judgment of others when we ourselves, you know, what, people in glass houses should not throw stones. But I used to judge him. But regardless of my hatred for him, and he probably didn't like me much better, he had the legs and I had the money. And so every day he'd go buy my booze. And every day I'd get sicker and sicker on my couch with my crutches. You know, and I just can even really visualize that picture, because I was only 26 years old and I was a pathetic wretch. 26 years old, I was coming to in my own waist because I couldn't get up. I just couldn't get up. I couldn't move. And eventually, in July of that year, in 79, something happened inside of me. Something clicked, and I can't really tell you what it was, other than what it talks about in our materials in the first step. It talks about there was a moment of clarity for each of us where we allowed that act of providence to really take hold. And I did not have a big white light. There was no band playing. Actually, my last drink was not even my worst. It wasn't even my worst. It was just on one day, on this particular day, I came to and I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And that's what it was. I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. So on this day, I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I prayed to God, it's the last time I'll have to go to my first meeting. I pray I don't ever have to make that trek again. Because the truth is, guys, for me, I don't think I would make it. You see, I work really, really hard in this program today because I don't even want to risk going out and not making it back. In the last 3 months, at meetings I've been to, I have seen more people with time go out. And these are just the ones that I've seen make it back. actually got even closer to home. One of my very first sponsees went out at 24 years sober. She's 24 years sober. She was sober a long time. That is a long time. But she forgot. She forgot. You know, and I often think, what is it that makes me different from somebody who goes out? Because my story was horrific. I don't always do things perfectly. And sometimes I think, okay, so what is it? Maybe it's the fact that I really do believe in a God today and I use that God. I don't know, maybe. A lot of people believe in God, though. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's that I just don't forget. Maybe it's that I'm not willing to forget where I've come from. And you see, I'm in a place in my life today where it becomes easy to forget. It becomes really easy to forget, and it could be quite convenient. I mean, number one, you know, people look at me in my real life, nobody would know I've come from where I've come from. But you see, I know. And I don't ever want to forget. And the only explanation I can make for many of the old-timers going out is that they forget. They forget. Do you know, I still do the same stuff I did when I was brand new and in sobriety. I don't go to as many meetings. I averaged, when I was new, 26, 27 meetings a week. I don't go to that many. But I go to meetings every week. I still sponsor. I take a meeting into the jail. I still do the stuff. I still do what I'm asked when I can do it. And I remember, I'm not ashamed to talk about my history because I don't want to forget. Well, the good news is this sponsee I hear is back. I hear she's back, you know. My prayer is she stays here because many people don't. I'm surprised I'm still sober, the truth is. Because you know what? I'm one of those people who came in here with a really, really, really bad attitude. I mean, maybe like some of you, maybe not. I had a bad attitude. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I sit in the back of the room in my favorite section, thank you. It was called the inventory section. Some of you can probably relate. Yeah, right on. I know. Right on. Inventory. I used to sit back there and I'd take up 3 seats. Now, I don't care who you are, you do not need 3 seats in an AA meeting. You do not. But I took up 3 seats. One for my bottom, one for my broken leg. I understand that. But one for my crutches. I put my crutches on a seat. Talk about an attitudinal problem. And I'd sit in the back and I'd cross my arms and I and I dare you to make my day. You know? I would just dare somebody to get up to the podium and say something that was going to make me want to keep coming back. And you didn't. You didn't. That's why I don't know why I'm still here, because you didn't. I hated you. I hated everybody. I hated men. I hated women. And that doesn't leave a whole lot of people in between. I hated everybody. I just didn't like anybody. I came and I buzzed. I took everybody's inventory. I mean, and there were a few of us like that in the inventory section, and we just chattered and chattered. But even though I didn't like men, I really hated women. I really, really, really hated women. And to tell you, I hated especially the women who got up to the podium and talked about how they used the 12 steps to change their life. And how they don't do those things they used to do anymore. I didn't want to hear that. They talked about, you know, how their lives were changed. They were redeemed. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. I thought, who do you think you are? I don't care. You know, those pompous women who were in recovery. I didn't want to hear from them. Thank you. I like the girls like me who used to come in with little nothing on and sleep with other people's husbands. Those are my kind of girls. I liked them. Because, you see, they couldn't take my inventory because we were doing the same thing. What I eventually realized was that I didn't like women in Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't like me. It was that simple. There was no other reason. You see, I came in with so much self-loathing, so much self-hatred that I hated anybody who reeked of health, anybody who even showed a semblance of good judgment or class. See, I wasn't in that place. I looked like the hooker that I was when I came in here. I was very lucky that I met a sponsor at 30 days, and, you know, God bless her. Three of my mentors have died over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and Louise, Hal Marley, and Dr. Paul were three of the most important people in my life. And Louise was my sponsor. And I have to tell you, I hated her too. I hated her especially because she was just, number one, she was too old to remember what it was like to be young and cute. You know, she was 59 years old. So I know people are looking at me that way today. She was 59. She was 19 years sober. She just long since forgot what it was like to be new and fun and energetic. That was my thinking. And all she ever talked about was action and gratitude and service and God. Hello? I didn't care about those things. I'm 26 years old. I want to go play. I mean, my idea of fun was hanging out at the brewery, even in sobriety. I mean, I wasn't drinking, but I was hanging out at Jubilation, at the discos. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be talking about God or service. I mean, if we were going to talk about service, it's what could you do for me? What's in it for me? That was the radio station I liked, WIIFM. That was my idea of fun. God, and you want to know why I think I shouldn't be sober or why I'm still here? Louise was, she was interesting. You know, I disliked her for the very reason I eventually loved her over time. And God bless her. She died with about 43, 44 years of sobriety, and she helped many, 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 many women in that area. And many of you, if there's a delegate in here, she served on a panel for many years. She was very active in service. And, you know, I disliked her, again, for the same reason I eventually loved her, because she was the one who had the courage to tell me the truth about who I was. You see, she wasn't out to make friends. That wasn't her job as a sponsor. And she was very clear with me from the very beginning, I'm your sponsor, I am not your pal. And I didn't like that because I wanted somebody who was going to be my pal. I wanted that. But you see, sometimes when we become too entrenched, too embroiled with sponsees, we don't have the courage to tell them the truth when they need to hear the truth. And I'm so grateful that I had a sponsor who was clear, who was crystal clear on her role. You see, she loved me more than I was capable of loving myself. She saw in me something that I was in that I couldn't see in myself. And she had the courage to call me on the things that were getting in my way. I'd like to share with you three things in particular that Louise taught me. And if something resonates with you, it's great, but these are really the things that were important for me. The first thing, well, overall, the message that she taught me was that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. That self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts, not thinking or feeling, but doing. It comes from taking the black words off the white page in the blue book. That's what she taught me. It comes from doing something different. And so the first thing she taught me was that it was not an esteemable act that I should be sleeping with other people's husbands. Period. Period. She said, there's no justification for that. Period. I said, but wait, Louise. You don't understand. What happens if I'm walking down the street and a guy is holding on to his honey and he's giving me the eye? What should I do? It's not my fault if he's looking at me, winking. She said, excuse me, she said, you turn your head. That simple. She said, you turn your head and you do not engage him. I said, but you don't understand. But she understood. She had my number from the very beginning. You do not sleep with other people's husbands or boyfriends and justify that it's not their husband. Period. She said, it is not an esteemable act. She said, you can keep doing all the things you've been doing in your life, but you better believe you're going to keep getting exactly what you're getting. And if you don't like who you are, you need to take a look at the way you are behaving. So that was the first thing she taught me, and I must tell you, I stand before you this morning proud that I am a woman who can say that I haven't messed with anybody's husband in a long, long, long time. And there's not, well, I don't blame you for clapping. It's a good thing, too, because if I was still on the rampage, you guys would be in trouble. You know? I remember when I was new, I used to go up to guys. This is when I was still acting out and touching their shirts and, you know, with their wives right there. It's like, how inappropriate. Today there's not one single woman in this room or any room who would ever have to worry about me in the room with your man. That might not mean a lot to you, but it's an esteemable act for me. You see, my sobriety today is not just about not drinking and using. And there are people who will tell you that it's only about not drinking. There are people who will tell you that, but I'm going to tell you, all you have to do is open up the AA literature and it tells you loudly and clearly that this is about a personality change. It's about changing our behavior. 11 out of the 12 steps are about changing behavior. Changing behavior. Only the first one talks about not drinking. It says we must change our behavior, you know, if we're going to sustain recovery over the long haul. So that was the first thing she taught me. And the truth is, too, I have enough to deal with my own husband today. I don't need yours. Mine is a piece of work, you know. He's enough. Second thing Louise taught me was how to dress. Now, picture this. Like I said, I'm a hooker. That's how I came in here. So a sash. You know how big a sash is? About 6 inches. I used to walk into AA meetings. I swear to God, this is not a lie. I used to walk into AA meetings with hot pants the size of a sash. They were so small that my cheeks would be hanging out, and I am not talking about my facial cheeks. And I'd be sashaying around the meeting thinking I was the pussycat's meow. I'd wear tops that were so tiny, I might as well not have had that piece of ribbon on in the first place, you know, because they were covering nothing. And not that I'm a very small woman, but still, whatever I had was available for you to see. That's how I used to dress. And I couldn't figure out how come all the men wanted my phone number and none of the women ever wanted to talk to me. My God. Duh. Louise taught me that it was inappropriate to dress that way. She said, you can wear bikinis, but you wear them on the beach or at a pool, but not in an AA meeting. It's that simple. I've learned how to dress appropriately for the occasion. I wear short skirts, but I wear them when it's appropriate. And I do not wear them all the way up the crack in my behind. Period. The third thing she taught me that was really critical for me as a woman, because again, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And sobriety taught me how to put the drink down. And then the rest of the 12 steps were about changing my life. The third thing for me was Louise taught me how to use different language to describe how I felt. I had a filthy mouth, and that's about as plain as I can get. I cursed simply because I could. And thanks to her, she helped me realize that every single time I cursed, just like with the dressing, when I cursed, I got attention. And it didn't matter that it was negative attention, but it was attention. And when you come in and you hate yourself as much as I've hated myself, any attention is better than none. Any attention. She played a trick on me once. We were in a conversation, and she taped the conversation. And then she played it back. I mean, she was like no good, I'm telling you. She just down and dirty. She didn't care. She loved me enough to tell me the truth, and she didn't care that I didn't like her. She played the tape back to me, and I must tell you, even I was appalled. Even I. Every word was a curse. It was so horrible. I mean, it really was very sad that I did not know any other words to use. She also helped me realize that every time I cursed, I took the focus off of me, the message, took it off my message and put it on me as the messenger. Now, when I was newly sober, I didn't have a message, so I didn't care that you didn't listen to it. But today I do. And I don't want you to get distracted by curse words. I don't want you to be focused on the cursing. I want you to hear the message from my heart. I want you to hear the message. I want you to watch the message in action. She taught me that. She taught me self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And I could curse my way into a conversation or not. I'd like to tell you that it was really easy to stop, but it wasn't. The truth is, when you've been doing bad things or you've got bad behavior patterns that have been a part of your life for years and years, they don't just stop. And so With the cursing, for example, you know, and this is so true, she helped me reduce my cursing content from like 10 curse words to a sentence to like 5 curse words to a sentence. And then it went to like 3 curse words to a sentence. And then it was like every other sentence had a curse word until eventually I stopped cursing. Eventually I just stopped. And on the rare occasion I would hear a word come out of my mouth, it so stunned even me because I wasn't using the language. I learned how to use different words to describe how we feel. And you know how I really started using different words? The dictionary. In the big book in the 12 and 12, they had some of these big words that I didn't understand. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I had no clue what rapacious meant or vicissitude. Never even heard of it. And so Louise used to send me to the dictionary, and I had a dictionary as I was reading the big book in the 12 and 12. And every time I saw a new word, I'd write down the meaning. But I started getting interested in the dictionary. And I just started to discover a whole new world of words, of verbiage that I never knew. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. What she was also teaching me at this stage of my life, I was about 2 years sober when this was starting to happen, was that I could not only change the insides, but I could change the outsides, and I could change my entire life if I wanted. And it was in 2 years that I made a decision to go back to school. And that was a big, big, big to-do for somebody like me. Again, I'm an ex-hooker with a criminal record, and I was a high school dropout. And so education obviously was never important to me. And not one of those men who used to pay my bills ever asked me where I went to finishing school. They didn't ask me if I had a degree. They didn't even care if I could read. They didn't even care if I could speak. You know, they just wanted me to physically show up. That was all. They didn't care about the rest of that. But you know what, guys? At 2 years sober, I started to care. At 2 years sober, because of what you were starting to teach me, I started to care about being a woman of substance. You know, for the first time in my life, I wanted to not just be eye candy. For the first time in my life, I wanted not to just be a trophy on somebody's arm. For the first time in my life, I wanted not to just be somebody that somebody slept with and then let go. I really wanted to be somebody who had something inside of her. I wanted to have a mind, which I never thought I had. And so when I was 2 years sober, I decided to go back to school. And the thing is, I went and pursued a career that was bigger than me, way bigger than me. And let me just stop here and say that, you know, my sobriety beyond getting sober has really been about walking through my fear. It's been about doing all kinds of things that I've been scared to do. Because getting sober was a scary proposition. But then after I got sober and removed the chemicals, I was really scared. I woke up and I realized, oh my God, you know, this is a big world and it's frightening. And I didn't like to admit that I was afraid, but I was. I was afraid of everything. And I remember 2 years, Louise used to say, you know, Francine, you can do anything you want in sobriety if you are willing to do the footwork. She said, you can have anything. She said, the sky is the limit for you today. But I used to say, yes, but, a lot. It was one of my favorite words. I said, but you don't understand. Yes, but, Louise. She said, Francine, you can have anything you want if you are willing to do the work. She said, if you want to sit back and blame the fact that you're black for why you can't do anything in your life, go for it. She said, if you want to sit back and blame the fact that you're a girl and you can't do anything in your life, have fun. And she said, if you want to sit back and use your history as an excuse for staying stuck, then be my guest. She said, you can use anything you want or you can use nothing as an excuse. She said, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that it's going to be an easy journey for somebody like you. She said, you've got a lot of things to overcome. Not the least of which was a criminal record. But she said, if you are willing to do the work, God and Alcoholics Anonymous will show you how to do it. And I have to tell you, I stand before you this morning, such an example of the fact that anything is possible. I told you I was a leaker. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. Not sorry. Anything is possible. It took me 10 years to get through school. 10 long years. I had a dream. I had a dream that was, again, bigger than me. And I had to get my GED. So when I was still in Las Vegas in 1981, I got my GED. And then I started college at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And then I moved back to New York City because the education I needed, they didn't have in Vegas at the time. Plus, I didn't want to be there anymore. And I moved back to New York, and I worked my way through college. I worked full-time, I went to school full-time, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And I like to particularly share that because I've discovered in my years of sobriety that newcomers, particularly those between the delicate years of 1 and 5, who go back to school or who change jobs or get in the right relationship, all of a sudden have no time to go to meetings. You know, they forget what it is that made it possible for them to do the things they were doing in the first place. And then if they do show up in a meeting, then we have to listen to all the stuff that's been built up over the months. God help us. And while sobriety works under those conditions, you can come to meetings once a month if you want. It'll work, maybe. But why make it hard? And Louise used to say to me, Francine, you should never forget how it's possible that you are sitting in a classroom, that you are using a mind that you have wasted. She said, if no other reason you show up at AA meetings, if you can't come for yourself, you come for others. But she says, bottom line, you need to be here for yourself. You need to not forget. Again, a lot of old timers go out because they forget. They forget. So I worked my way through school, and then in 1986, I moved down to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And in 1989, I moved back to New York, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can tell you, it might not mean much to you guys, but for an ex-hooker with a criminal record who used to pay lawyers a fortune to keep her out of jail, today I am one of them. Today I'm one of them, you know? I'm in that family. And I'd like to tell you that it didn't happen easily. You know, it's really important that I share with you the failures because so many of us in sobriety have dreams. We want to do big things in life. And sobriety lets us, but we're scared. We're scared of failing. We're scared of making a mistake. We're afraid of being rejected. And before I became a lawyer, I failed the bar many, many, many times. And there are many people in this room who's heard me because every time I failed, God had another conference for me to speak at. It was like horrible. And because I'm one of those people who believes in telling the truth, I kept telling you. And you just loved me back to health. You loved me and you loved me and you loved me. And failed it again and passed it. And I mean, I went through the process. But the point is I was in the game. I did not show up because I was afraid to fail. That's what the 12 steps in God have given me. I was willing to show up for my life, and as a result, I got a life. I got a life. In 1993, Dr. Paul, who was as close to me as a sponsor, but because I happen to be one of those people who believes men sponsor men and women sponsor women, that's my opinion only, because I believe that Dr. Paul was never considered my sponsor, but he was a very close friend. He was one of my mentors. And in 1993, Dr. Paul came to me because I was pretty weary, didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. I mean, go figure, you worked so hard to get it, and then, oh, well, I know I could do it. And I have that license. But in 1993, Dr. Paul, I was struggling through a lot of stuff, and Dr. Paul said, you know, you have a book inside of you. I think you should be writing books, because he had just published a couple of books. And I said, yeah, but, you know, again, that fear is a powerful thing. I said, yeah, but. Well, long story short, Dr. Paul was the one who encouraged me to write my first book. And then when Esteemable Acts came out, then we did another. But unfortunately, Dr. Paul was not around to see either book when they came out. But you know what? In both of my books, in the acknowledgement section, he's talked about because he was so inspirational in me even having the courage to put pen to paper. That's a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. A gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was newly sober and I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of my sobriety, you would have found a litany of every single material thing I wrote, I had. You would have found fur coats and diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos. That's what you would have found on that list of tangibles. Tangibles. That's all I would have said I wanted back, because that's all that would have been important. But you know, like so many of us, I would have shortchanged myself had I gotten just what was on that list. The greatest gifts I've received in my sobriety have been those intangibles, those things that you can't take away from me unless I give them up. The greatest gifts I've received are things like self-esteem, the genuine kind, not the kind where I stand in the mirror and tell myself how great I am, because that does not work. Doesn't. What I've found works for me in terms of building real self-esteem through sobriety is doing esteemable acts. Every single time I've done something that I was afraid to do, that was an esteemable act. Staying sober over the long haul when it got really tough was an esteemable act. Every time I've done something I didn't think I could do, going back to school was an esteemable act. Getting up after I was knocked down after another failure was an esteemable act. Running a marathon when people told me I was in my 40s and I should be thinking about walking, not running, that was an esteemable act. Every time I've done something I didn't think I could do, with God's help, that's what helped to build self-esteem. You'd find that on my list today. What you'd also find on my list today is courage. I used to think that courage was an absence of fear. And today I know all courage is a willingness to admit that I am afraid, to feel my fear, and get through it. That's real courage. That you'd find on my list today. What you'd also find on my list today is the gift of a God, a power greater than myself. I was an agnostic when I got sober. And if you're newly sober, the only difference between an atheist and an agnostic is an agnostic knows that there is something there, but just not for them. See, I was raised a Southern Baptist, so I knew there was God. But God wasn't my friend. Not that God that I grew up with. That wasn't my friend. So I kind of ostracized God. Didn't want to know anything about it. And today, one of the greatest gifts I've been given in recovery is the gift of a power greater than myself. I am the person in the 11th step who says I would no more do without my faith than I would air, food, or sunshine. What you'd also find on that list today is the gift of my mom. And I know that's a really tough thing to talk about in a meeting with women, but it's an important gift for me that I need to talk about always to acknowledge my mother today. I hated my mom so much when I got sober. And I was grateful for every AA meeting that I walked into where I heard women bashing their moms. I was grateful because I didn't feel like a leper. But I must tell you, because I consistently learned how to take the black words off the white pages in the blue book, I eventually learned that it wasn't about just not drinking. It was about my behavior in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned how to practice these principles in my family. And as a result, today my mom is one of my best friends. You know, my mom's really sick. She's getting on. She's very sick. And if my mother were to drop dead right at this very moment, I'd feel so sad. I'd feel so hurt. But you know what? There is no unfinished business. No unfinished business. There would not be a stitch of guilt because I have done the right thing by my mother in my sobriety. Today I'm a good daughter. I act like a good daughter. I don't just talk like I act like a good daughter. I act like a good daughter. My mother's a part of my life. And finally, what you find on that list today is the gift of love. And not the kind that we just sometimes give a lot of chatter to. Because it's easy to say, I love. I love everybody. But my feet don't move in that direction. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to stand up here and tell you that I believe we are all at one, and you don't see anybody in my life who looks different from me. See, I'd be really hard-pressed to stand up here and tell you that I love God's kids, and everybody in my life looks the same. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you that I'm working the spiritual program, and you don't see anybody who's different in my life. And so, again, for me, taking the black words off the white page in the blue book is about practice. It's about how do I behave. And in my life, you see diversity. The women I sponsor are of all different races, Asian, Black, Latino, white. My friends are of all different persuasions, including gay. And in my family, in my personal family, my husband's different from me. My husband's Jewish, and he's from the Bronx. Go figure. Jewish and from the Bronx. And that's not even the real diversity issue in my family. The real diversity issue is that he's a therapist. He's a therapist. Go figure, a lawyer and a therapist. Hello. Again, it's one thing to talk a really good loving game. It's another to put it into practice. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to have an open heart when I did not want to. It's taught me that it's not always been easy to be loving when people don't treat you that way. But I wanted to share this last story with you about how this has worked for me in my life. My husband this past week flew to Florida to see his dad. His dad was taken off of life support. He's very, very ill right now. And Henry's about 94. And, you know, my heart's just with him. I love his father, actually, today. And that was not always the case. So actually, I should say his father loves me, and that was not always the case. His father was not willing to meet me when we first got together. And he made no bones about it. He did not want a black woman in the family. He did not mince his words. He wasn't coming to the wedding. He wanted no part of this deal. And you know what you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous? Again, you taught me how to put my feet where my mouth is. And all during the time he was saying what he had to say, I just kept praying to stand in my own light and come from a loving place. And not just give it lip service. When he'd call, I was friendly. You know, I would sometimes, on his birthday, I would call him. I would do little things that were appropriate, not over the top, but appropriate. And do you know what? Eventually, he came around. I believe he came around because of you. Because without you teaching me the things that I've learned, I wouldn't, believe me, my attitude would have been, who do you think you are? I can do the same thing too. And I would have come up against him like this, because that's what we do. You treat me mean, I'm going to treat you mean too. Well, that's not what works for me anyway today. It used to work well, but it's not who I want to be anymore. I heard Donald Trump recently talk about when people treat him that way, he treats them that way. Fine. That's not how I want to live today. And because I didn't live that way, because I didn't do that, Henry came around. He was at the wedding. But more than that, every week my father-in-law and I talk on the phone. Every week we're on the phone. Do you know the other day when he came out of his condition where he was capable of talking, he asked for me on the phone. I couldn't believe it. And so Richard put the phone next to him. He knew who I was. That's a little thing, but yet it's a big thing. It's a big thing that I've gotten from you. I am so grateful to be sober. I have so much to be blessed. I have so much to be appreciative for. I want to end with this. I always like to read this page from As Bill Sees It as I close out my talk. And this is from As Bill Sees It. As you can see, it's very used. It's my favorite book. I'm a book baby. I got sober with the books. And my most favorite books in Alcoholics Anonymous are this and The 12 and 12. These are my two most favorite books because they are purely instruction books. When I come in here saying, but I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do in this situation, all I need to do is open up the instruction books. Even more than the big book, the 12 and 12 and As Bill Sees It tell me exactly how to behave. Talks about gossip, talks about all that stuff. So I like to end with this talk, this page, and it's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And I just want to say thank you so much for the gift of choice. You've taught me that it doesn't matter where I come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, Does it matter whether I believe in God or I don't? That the only thing that matters in the overall scheme of things is that I am willing, that I am willing to give back some of this most precious gift that I've been given. And not just when it's convenient, and not just in an AA meeting. You've taught me it's, how do I act out there in traffic when somebody cuts me off? What's the language I'm very quick to use when that happens? Or how do I behave on the line in the supermarket when people are moving just a little too slowly for my taste? Or how do I take the 12 steps into my family? Do I treat my husband like a dog and treat my sponsees like little goddesses? All you've asked of me is that I be willing to remember the gift you've given me and that I always am willing to pass it on. And for that, I am so grateful. Thank you. Thank you.